This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, some people living near Donkin Mine say they are fed up with noise pollution. A Sydney woman in her 90s recalls gliding around the ice with hundreds of others. We'll hear about an upcoming multicultural event. We have a professor's point of view on the financial troubles for convenience stores, and a popular weekend market is on the move. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Members of a local group concerned with industrial noise coming from the Donkin Mine are discussing their recent meeting with a local MLA. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Postlewaite reports.
A release from the Cow Bay Environmental Coalition details their meeting with Cape Breton East MLA and Minister of Mental Health and Addictions Brian Comer, as well as a call for their concerns to now be treated as a public health issue. The issue stems from over 7 years of advocacy from residents of Donkin, who have lodged complaints about pure tone frequency noise coming from industrial fans at the Donkin Mine. Despite the mine remaining unopened after a work stop order was lifted in March 2024, residents say noise from the fans has continued and is adversely affecting their health. Kat Ferguson is an outspoken member of the Cow Bay Environmental Coalition and discussed their meeting with Minister Comer.
It went well in the sense that, you know, we were pleased to have a meeting with our MLA, Brian Comer. What's interesting is they're really focused on noise testing, and all they want to do is talk about noise testing or compliance within the noise guidelines. And they've had 7 years to test, and the community continues to experience deteriorating mental and physical health from the noise from the Donkin Mine. So in that way, it's a little bit frustrating. I don't feel they're grasping or they're willing to grasp the seriousness of the health issue that people in the area are being affected by. And it kind of feels like sometimes, like often our concerns are falling on deaf ears. So that part was disappointing, but that's what we've come to expect from this government.
For years, the Department of Environment and Climate Change has been the point of contact between the Donkin residents and the government, but Ferguson says the coalition wants the issue to be framed as a health matter, not an environmental one.
What I'm hopeful for, and what we're all hopeful for, is that we asked him to set up a meeting with the Minister of Health, because we want them to make our health a priority. Under the umbrella of the two ministers who have the health portfolios, mental health and addictions and health and wellness, we're asking that they address our health concerns with the urgency that it deserves. We want a clear commitment from them that our health is prioritized and that they stop the Donkin Mine noise. There's also the Nova Scotia Health Protection Act, and that recognizes noise and vibration as potential health hazards for affected people. And also, World Health Organization states that pure tone, low frequency noise requires urgent mitigation because of the effects it has on people's health. So we think that, you know, this is a very important issue, and we're hopeful that MLA Brian Comer will move this forward and set up a meeting with the Minister of Health.
She spoke more about what she hopes would come from a meeting with the Department of Health and Wellness.
Well, what we want is for this government to act on stopping the source of the pure tone low frequency noise that's coming from the ventilation fans. We want it framed under the issue of health, not environment, because it's gone beyond environment. It's affecting the health of residents. So we want it framed that way, and we want action taken to finally stop this industrial noise. This government is moving forward, is doubling down on extractive industry, and we feel this is also a good opportunity for them to demonstrate to Nova Scotians that they take the health of local residents and environment within extractive industry seriously. And they can demonstrate this by stopping the noise, industrial noise coming from those fans.
Ferguson also shared her frustrations with the ongoing issue of the noise.
I think what it comes down to, right, is that this government historically keeps talking about the more testing. the noise guidelines they have are flawed and they don't protect public health. The government's position is to support company-managed testing, and the noise is mysteriously absent during testing periods. And so it feels like that's just a stalling tactic. And so that's why we're moving forward with the request that our MLA, who is also the Minister of Health and Mental Health and Addictions, meet with the Minister of Health and Wellness.
Another member of the coalition, Tina Warren, echoed Ferguson's frustrations with the lack of action from government. She spoke about her connection to the Donkin area and the mine noise issue.
So I have relatives in Homeville, New Waterford, Glace Bay area, because my mom is from New Waterford, my grandfather, and one of the original settlers of Stetson Homes. So that's my family background. And I go summers and visit Homeville. And the last time I was there, this past year, I was speaking to all my relatives, and there's quite a few of them there, like at least half a dozen. And the one thing that kept coming up was the noise from the Donkin mine. So I just felt that I owed it to them to speak up, because many of them were very worried about saying anything. I mean, the Donkin mine's a very powerful mine. They wanted to have the noise stop, but they didn't know what to do anymore, because they had tried so many things with local council, with the province, elected officials. There was the work of the Cal Bay Environmental Coalition, and they even commissioned a study and a petition. And this is 7 years worth of suffering about the noise. So that's why I got involved. I just felt I owed it to my relatives.
She spoke more about the conditions her relatives are facing.
Well, sleepless nights, and one of my cousins actually moved away from the area. They were living across the mine. I think it's about 7 kilometers away. So at night, during the day, it was a relentless noise. I understand it's a high tonal noise. And this isn't just coming from one. I mean, I don't want to name them out of respect to them. In confidence, I could, but just so you know. And many of them are elderly now, and this is their home, and they just don't feel it's fair. They're also worried about the methane. It's one of the largest methane-producing sites in all of Cape Breton. So that's on their minds as well. But they've suffered sleepless nights and headaches. They can feel it. It's like the noisiest, loudest appliance constantly going. So that's my connection to the mine.
She shared her feelings on the meeting between the coalition and Minister Comer.
I think Brian is sincere trying to help us with this issue. And it's really important that the health minister really addresses the regulation around noise, because the levels are unsafe, unhealthy. And it's as if the health ministry and the government wants to side with the mine and be in denial and not change anything. And in fact, it almost feels like it's up to citizens to cope. It's not a government matter. But we know legally it is. And we said, and that was said to Brian, that the provincial government has responsibility for that noise, and they set the regulations, and they are the license holder, and it's up to them to make their community safe. And these are democratic communities. They vote for their elected officials. And if you can't trust them to make things happen to protect their health, who can you trust?
Those were members of the Cal Bay Environmental Coalition speaking about their meeting with MLA Brian Comer and their ongoing concerns with the Donkin mine noise. Coast 89.7 News reached out to Minister Comer to comment on the meeting with the coalition. He was unavailable but provided this statement, quote, "I always welcome the opportunity to hear directly from community members about the issues that matter to them. Residents were encouraged to measure noise levels. The meeting was constructive, and I appreciate the coalition taking the time to share their perspectives. Our government is committed to making decisions that are good for Nova Scotian families, for their health, their communities, and their economic future," unquote. The Coast 89.7 newsroom has also reached out to the Department of Health and Wellness and the Department of Environment and Climate Change, but has yet to receive a response.
Stepping by. times we hunt with you. Going way back to 1942. We're dancing to an old Cole Porter tune. Stepping back in time, sweetheart, with you.
A Sydney woman who's turning 92 soon loves to talk about ice skating. Shirley Lydicka is well known at most of the arenas in the CBRM. She lost her eyesight when she was in her 50s, but she was not ready to hang up the skates. Lydicka says her passion for skating started at a young age.
Oh, I started skating when I was 9, 10 years old. I never had skates, but I had my brother's skates, and I put my shoes in them. And I skated up and down the sidewalk in front of where I lived. That's how I learned to skate. And then I started going to the old Sydney Forum, eh? For 10 cents on Saturday mornings from 10 to 12. And then eventually I got a little older, so I was allowed to go Saturday afternoon, and it was 20 cents. And then a little later, I got to go Saturday nights, and that was 20 cents. Well, I could see then. I had no problem then, you know. The only thing different girls were saying, how come you don't go over your ankles? But I didn't tell them I had shoes and my skates.
Lydicka says the neighborhood looked different back then in downtown Sydney when she found her love of ice skating.
Well, it felt real good to me, you know. That I learned to skate on the sidewalk in front of our place where we lived. We lived on the corner of Townsend and George. You know where that is?
Yes.
And it was a big block there, and Brooke's store was underneath us. Remember that, Brooke's store? You would remember.
No, I don't.
No, you probably are too young.
Lydicka says she was eventually gifted her own pair of skates. Life got busy, but she kept gliding along.
And then when I was 13, my brother bought me a pair of racers. And I wore them for years. Then after I got married, I got a new pair. But that was later on, you know. But I skated as much as I could after I got married because I worked and then I had two children.
Lydicka says she lost her eyesight when she was in her 50s and she took a break until one day it was time to get back to what she enjoyed the most.
Then when I had to leave work and when I lost my sight and that, I was off for 5 years. Then I decided I'm going back. I'm going to skate. I'm going to go down. I said to Rich, my husband, I'm going down the rink tonight. He said, you can't go down there. I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll find out when I go down. Skate is 7 days a week for over 29 years.
Lydicka says the others would guide her onto the ice and then skate with them for a few laps at the many rinks in the CBRM. One of those is her friend and my father, Bernie McCush.
I remember Shirley and everybody was in awe when they seen Shirley's skating. And if you want to skate with Shirley, there was kind of a lineup. Whoever skated with her was kind of a badge of honor. I skated with Shirley today. So it was the odd time I would sneak in there. And she had this trust with the skaters that if you ask me to skate, I'm going because I'm not going to stand by the boards. Isn't that right, Shirley?
Yeah, right.
Lydicka recalls one gentleman who cracked a joke, not realizing she was blind.
Well, it didn't matter, really. Once I got there and got used to the rink and the people, you know, and I knew most of the voices. That's how I learned, you know. And then one fella had came and skated with me. I knew somebody different. I said, now, I'm blind. Well, that's all right, he said. I'm blind in one eye, can't see in the other. And we laughed and finished the band and all that, and he took me back. But then he came back later and apologized. See, he didn't know that I couldn't see. And when he said that, made that remark, you know, he came back and apologized and said, that's okay. Yeah. And tell you who it was, because I forget the name now. He was in Dominion anyway.
Lydica says she only had a few accidents skating blind for about 3 decades.
When I lost the sight, and when I went back skating, I fell 4 times.
Yeah.
Because somebody cut feet from under me, cut in too close and took me down, eh? No. As long as I didn't get hurt, I went back.
Lydica says as the years went on, fewer and fewer people were showing up for the skating sessions, but she remembers when it was difficult to make her way through the large crowds, especially this one close call after an on-ice collision.
I skated when there was 350 there and 450 at the rink, and I was in the middle of them and couldn't see. And one of the fellows that I skated with, when we were making the turn, he hit this lady. She had fell and she was just getting up, and he hit her and she went down. He let me go, and I'm going down the rink with 350 people there with my arms out for somebody to grab me, eh? But anyway, I went quite a piece, and then somebody did grab me, take me. I didn't know how I was going to make that turn. I knew I had to make another turn. But anyway, this fellow from New Waterford, and I can't remember his name, but he was skating with his daughter, and he let her go, and she picked me up.
Mm-hmm. Her late husband, Richard Dick Lydica, was well known in the sports community. He played for the Sydney Millionaires. Lydica says hockey players have a different rhythm on the ice, and it didn't work out as well as planned.
Well, he just didn't go for skating to a band, you know, the music and that, you know. No, he was a hockey player, and he just didn't bother with the skating. Yeah, but I skated half a band with him, and I said, no, forget it, because all he was doing was jigging back and forth. He needed a stick, not an arm. He never ever bothered coming back.
Lydica says even though they didn't click when they were wearing ice skates, they did find other ways to stay active together, and that was dry land training.
After skating in the daytime, Rich and I walked. We'd walk for an hour and a half or two every day. Some days we were dropped off at the Mayflower Mall and we'd walk home.
Shirley said during the interview, it's important for people to move on regardless of challenges in life. She is well known at the guest home where she lives now and barely misses any of the activities for the residents throughout the week.
To step back in time with you. To step back in time with you.
We just heard from 92-year-old Sydney skater Shirley Lydica talking about her passion of skating even while she was visually impaired. And next, a Sydney public market is moving to a bigger space and hoping to draw more people in. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Postlewaite reports.
The Multicultural Association of Cape Breton's Sydney Public Market will be relocating their big Saturday market from its current location on 222 Charlotte Street to the NSCC Sydney Waterfront Campus on the Esplanade. The flagship community initiative from the Multicultural Association will have their first Saturday event at the NSCC campus on June 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And the association says it will transform the waterfront campus into a vibrant, high-energy cultural and economic hub. Multicultural Association Vice President Ocean Lee talked about why they're making the move and how the idea was developed.
We really love our space. We're still going to keep our space, but in the first month, we just knew we sort of outgrew the space because we had a lot of vendors and a lot of demand for it. And our current space at 222 Charlotte Street was quite cozy. So we're thrilled that we can work and collaborate with NSCC to have our market at the waterfront campus. It's sort of been in talks for like about a year, like we wanted to be in there. And NSCC folks wanted to especially promote community engagement and making sure like the campus is a community-based campus. So being able to collaborate, I think, is a wonderful opportunity for both NSCC, Waterfront, and ourselves with the Multicultural Association of Cape Breton. So the Multicultural Association of Cape Breton is the is the organization, and one of our projects is the Sydney Public Market. And one of our goals has always been to connect newcomers with the local community. So being able for newcomers and locals to have a cultural exchange and to connect and to learn from each other. So we had a wonderful time. And this is approaching our second year right now at the market.
Lee says they're looking to see if the space could work as a permanent home for the Big Saturday Market.
Our goal is to see if this could be our home. So we're going to work on, and for sure, having it in the summer and fall to have a market there. And then we'll probably just like being in communications with NSCC just to see how the collaboration is, and potentially we could potentially be there year round, or we might come back into Charlotte Street in the winter season when it's sort of like lower season and we have a more cozier space. But ideally, it'd be great if we just had the Sydney Public Market at the NSCC waterfront campus, because we think it's a great location, has parking. It's really accessible. Not only do they have parking, but there's street parking. It's right by the water. You have beautiful, and people walk through as well. So it's a really great downtown location. 222 also is a great location as well. So we'll continue to keep that space. And our goal is to have more of flagship vendors there that are sort of full time. And then we would love to have more of a retail space and eventually have also a co-working space where ethno community groups are able to connect with each other, because oftentimes we find through our experiences that newcomers come here and they really want to connect. So being able to have a co-working space for newcomers and having support for them, I think would be fantastic. So we're looking forward to keeping our space still at 222. It's just going to transform into a multicultural hub. And then we'll have our Sydney Public Market at NSCC Waterfront Campus. Gives us more breathing space and more room, and allows for more vendors as well. So typically we might only have maybe 15 to 20 vendors. We're able to have 30 plus vendors at the new location, and they have bigger space as well.
To help fill the new space at NSCC, the market is looking to recruit more vendors and local performers of all kinds. A link to an application form can be found on the Sydney Public Market Facebook page. Lee shared a message for potential vendors and performers.
Please sign up, register. We're always looking for really incredible new vendors, whether you're local and you lived here for over like 10, 20 years, or if you're a newcomer, this is a great way for you to connect with community and incubate your business idea. We're looking for bread makers. We're looking for Nigerian food entrepreneurs. We're looking for Vietnamese food entrepreneurs as well. We're looking for performers. So whether you play music or you dance, this is a great way. Feel free to check us out on our website at www.macapebreton.com. And then you can find out a link where you can register as a performer or as a vendor. But we're thrilled that there's a lot of interest with the Sydney Public Market and its move. And we hope to see everyone there come June 27, 2026.
Meanwhile, the principal of the NSCC Sydney Waterfront Campus is happy to welcome the Sydney Public Market into their space this summer. Carla Arsenal says they're incredibly excited.
You know, our location is, I think, ideal for the local community and visitors, you know, proximity to the boardwalk. We're really excited to work with them.
She discussed the potential for the market to stay year-round and if students could get involved.
I think, you know, we're certainly looking to have further conversation, and, you know, we're going to start for the summer and see how it goes. For the summer, we're going to, you know, we don't have as many students on campus during the summer months. We have two programs that will be running through the summer, and then our staff that will be there. But this is a weekend market. So, you know, I see it really being at this stage really more an opportunity to engage with community. Ideally, yes, maybe prospective students, but really an opportunity, I think, to showcase the campus and allow people the opportunity who maybe hadn't been through our doors, the opportunity to come visit the market and be part of that great cultural experience.
The Multicultural Association says the market will be open rain or shine. They say local musicians and the full vendor lineup for opening day and the summer will be announced via social media in the coming weeks.
Another Sydney mom and pop convenience store has closed its doors for good. More from reporter Jacob Postlewaite.
The Welton Street Mini Mart is the most recent standalone mom and pop style convenience store in Sydney to shutter. It comes on the heels of the recent closure of Max Convenience near Wentworth Park and the closures in the last decade of the Jimmy Dan's convenience store in Sydney's South End and Jack's Convenience in Ashby. I spoke with Cape Breton University economics professor Patrick de la Merande about the trend of local mom and pop convenience stores shutting down to offer insight into why they're closing their doors. So the reason I was reaching out is because I saw just yesterday that a convenience store here in Sydney, the Welton Street Mini Mart, is going to be closing its doors. And it's one of many, actually, in the area that have closed their doors recently and in the last few years. I think there was another one called Max Convenience. So what kind of insight can you give us into why we're seeing these local mom and pop convenience stores close down?
For the way it is really a question of the switching in the market base, for one reason. Convenience stores are selling tobacco products and lottery tickets, and they're making a lot of their revenues from those two sources. But what we saw from the historical data is there's a decrease in cigarettes and lottery tickets as well. Atlantic Corporation for lotteries are making money, but they're doing way more money now than in the past from online tickets, from online games, and way less from the retails. So those kind of revenues were kind of a steady source of sources of revenues for convenience stores. And yeah, it's less the case now. So it's even more complicated for the convenience stores. So this is one of the reasons that could explain the decrease and the closing of retail convenience stores.
Okay.
Another reason is the inflation that we saw lately. Okay. Convenience stores are markets. It's a typical market where the margin of profit is very thin. So some changes could have a huge impact on the profitability of convenience stores. And with inflation that we saw over since the pandemic, that's what created a lot of pressures on the convenience stores to find ways to look for cutting costs, and it was kind of difficult for them to do it.
Yeah, and what kind of effect do chain convenience stores have, like needs? Are those also another factor in the kind of decline of these mom-and-pop shops?
What do you mean by this?
Well, you know, you see needs convenience stores around. Do those kind of take business away? Are those kind of a factor in this as well?
Clearly, it could play a big impact because one of the sources of revenues that is a real benefit from those chains of convenience stores is all the importing and the supply management. Since they have more convenience store to fill, they can have a better network to supply those markets and to supply those convenience stores. So that gives them an advantage in terms of costs versus the local retail stores with no such access to the network and to better prices.
Okay. And that was pretty much everything I had, unless there's anything you wanted to mention about this, something we might not have touched on, or any other points about it.
Well, one thing that that we can think about is also the impact of eventually, and it's just starting, but it's the impact of the electric cars that will have on some gas stations and eventually the convenience stores that will have some aspect. But I don't think in the late experience of closing that will be an impact, but maybe in the future it will be. But no, I think there is something that maybe we overlook is the impact of Uber Eats or all the delivery services in terms of food. Because sometimes when people will say, hey, we need something, we want to eat something tonight, we don't want to go out, we can just bring something from the convenience stores. But now it's easier just to dial up, call Uber Eats and order something from Uber Eats directly.
Right.
And this could have an impact as well on local convenience stores.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking a sec to chat with me. This was really good.
Okay, perfect.
That was CBU economics professor Patrick de la Merande speaking about mom-and-pop convenience store closures in the Sydney area. Other standalone mom-and-pop convenience stores still operating in the Sydney area include Terrace Convenience on Terrace Street and Mi'kmaq Gas and Convenience and John Kay's Convenience in Member 2.
On Saturday, June 27th, from 5 to 9 p.m., you'll be able to see the world without leaving the island. The Multicultural Association of Cape Breton and the CBRM are hosting Canadian Multicultural Day at Open Hearth Park. And here's Dialogue's Cora Perrigo with the association's Anna Gutierrez.
Canadian Multiculturalism Day is a celebration inviting people to celebrate the different cultures that are here in Cape Breton.
So what does it mean to you to kind of participate in it?
Well, it's a celebration of the diversity and all the new cultures that and old cultures that have been arriving to Cape Breton, how the mix of those make such a wonderful place to live.
Where is it happening? When's it happening?
It's happening on Saturday, June 27, from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Open Heart Amphitheater. It's a family-friendly event filled with food, performance, and cultural activities from around the world.
So what are those foods and, like, can you give any kind of, I guess, preview?
Sure. So in terms of food, we're going to have fruit from Latin America, from Vietnam, Chinese food, food from Filipinas, Korean. It's a delicious, like, joy of different cuisines from around the world.
And what kind of events will be happening?
So we're going to have a stage where there's going to be performances. Groups like the Chinese Dragon Culture Heritage, Vietnamese Dance Group, Folks Arts Group, and the Heritage African Drummers are going to be performing on stage.
What would you say about the importance of having these events, especially we've seen like racist graffiti around? What would you say about the importance of kind of continuing to expose people to the cultures around them?
I think when we, like, reduce the gap to the unknown of the new cultures, that bring us all together. And food and art is some, like, a platform that really make people, like, unite and come around something that is of interest of all the cultures. So that helps a lot with understanding other cultures, understanding what they're bringing to Cape Breton and how having a more diverse and more culturally rich place, it's beneficial for everyone that lives here at this beautiful island.
Is there a cost to attend the event?
No, the event is free, and it's also really interesting because food, like all the food, is going to be available just for $5, which is an awesome price, and you're going to be able to try like food that you don't have to travel around the world. The world is coming to you to try new things.
And I know we're in June, but the weather's been so bad. What would you say, I guess, about getting people outside, getting people out to these events, you know, in this time where, you know, we're like, where is summer?
Well, I think the last winter we have was very long. So just coming out and enjoying, and also warmth not only from the sun, but the people too. But in case if it's raining, we're going to have like a plan B. So the plan B at the Coxheath Arena. In case it's raining, we're still going to enjoy this amazing event.
Where can people kind of keep track on if the location changes or any kind of previews, anything like that?
Follow us on social media, Multicultural Association of Cape Breton, and CVRM is also posting everything related to this event.
What, like, personally, are you most excited to see at the event? Or what food are you most excited to partake in?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm a newcomer myself, so I guess whenever something comes from my country, I'm from Colombia, I will be pleased to see, like, the Latino culture. But also, it's really, like, I cannot say one because it's so many different and very nice things, food. We have also not only performances, but also, like, artist stage, artist booth, where people can go and make some arts and crafts from different cultures. So that's a very tough question. I think being part of, like, having the world in this specific weekend, it will be my key thing.
And what would you say, I guess, to the newcomer community about coming out to this event?
That this is a celebration for them. So come and join us, teach about your culture. Each one of us is ambassador. So I guess this is the perfect platform to be there, to collaborate and to enjoy also other cultures that are around.
And I guess what would you say also to kind of, you know, the local community? What would you say to them about coming out to this event and trying out all these new cultures? And, you know, maybe the fear that they're going to get something wrong, you know, what would you say to, I guess, like Westerners?
To come. Nowadays, airplanes are really expensive. So this is an amazing way of travel the world without going anywhere else. Don't be afraid to learn from other cultures, to ask questions. As newcomers, we don't mind people asking, well, the right questions, of course, with respect. But we're really willing and we love to share from our history, our culture, our food. And this is a good way also to teach kids about diversity and about, like, respecting the others and how the others also respect the land they came and they're kind of living in. And I guess that's what makes Cape Breton great, like all this, the possibility of building through the diverse cultures that are right now here at the island.
It's funny when you said the airplane. It is true. You can experience all these cultures and, you know, with the cost of living so high, the fact that the event is free, the food is $5. What would you say, I guess, about the importance of that kind of accessibility, especially for an event that's about exploring other cultures that live around them?
Well, it's really important. I think what CVRM and us partnering with them want to do is everyone to be able to enjoy that money is not the cost. Someone is not part of it and not part of the conversation and enjoying the other cultures and how it really, it's just willing, the will to go and to participate, even if it's not a very good weather that day, just take advantage of what we have here and the cultures that are coming and how you don't need like a lot of money to be able to enjoy that. But you have it like right here.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
I think there's like a good hook to this event, and it's that they're going to be a special guest, have a special performance from Brazil. It's Bia Ferreira. So I guess she's world famous, so it's really nice to also come and be able to have her here with no cost. You don't have to pay an expensive ticket and just enjoy the mood, enjoy the vibrance of this event.
That was Ana Guterres about Canadian Multiculturalism Day at Open Hearth Park on June 27th.
Jennifer Dulesky is a prominent businesswoman working in Mabertou who was recently awarded as one of Atlantic Canada's most powerful women by Atlantic Business Magazine. She speaks to Dialogue's Cora Paragon.
Yeah, so the award is awarded to Atlantic Canada's 25 most powerful women in all diverse backgrounds and different types of organizations, from not-for-profits to corporate organizations to just about anything, really. People, I guess, are nominated, and it's about, you know, their leadership and their impact to their organization.
So with your impact and kind of your position, can you kind of take someone through kind of what a day looks like for you?
Sure. considering what I do and where I work, it's quite dynamic. So I work for the Member 2 Development Corporation, but as you know, I think most listeners would be aware that, you know, Member 2 is a First Nation community within the middle of Sydney, I guess. And we've got a number of business entities. We've got, I guess, 13 corporate entities. We've got a number of partnerships. Most notably, we've acquired Clearwater Seafoods with seven other indigenous companies or communities. And I sit on the board of Clearwater, as well as we've acquired New Dock and most recently Genoa Designs. And I sit on both of those boards as well. So, you know, day to day, I've got a team of people that I work with, mostly in the business development, marketing, and communication side of what we do. But I also spend a lot of time with those companies that we acquired and sitting on with their leadership in ensuring that our investment is moving in the right direction and that we are getting adequate input into those companies.
So with input into development with Indigenous communities, is environmental stewarding a focus as well? Like you said, with working with seafood, does that feel important to you?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, if you take Clearwater as an example, for us, it's very focused in science. We are very mindful not to, you know, overfish the resource. Everything we do is with a science lens involved. And, you know, that wasn't just Clearwater's way, but that obviously would be the way that anything that we look to invest in, we are always mindful of the environment. And, you know, that would be one of the things that we look at when we're investing in a company is, you know, do they have good stewardship?
Kind of on that note, you know, there's been maybe some controversy around other organizations, other development, entities about kind of, not having a focus on things like environmental stewardship or taking the science of something into account. Why do you feel that's so important for you?
Well, it's both sustainability. So for us, it's important that the investment that we make today is here for generations to come. So, if you're not looking at, if you're not making science-based decisions in organizations or companies like that, then, you know, you are at risk of not having that for the future generation. So when we look at an investment for Member 2, it's about, there's many factors we look at. So yes, there in some instances, we're looking at job creation, but most importantly, we're looking at wealth generation. So how are we bringing wealth back into the community? So these investments, you know, return and come back into the community, and then that helps to run our community. And so it's important to us that these, when we get into something, we buy it for the long term. We're not investors that like to flip investments. So we always have that lens. And I think that you would have heard, you know, Chief Terry speak many times about, you know, looking at seven generations. And so when we're looking to invest in something, it is always with a long-term lens. So obviously science is very important.
And you said that you don't, you're not used to talking about yourself, but you seem, you know, especially with the award that you've been given, you seem like someone as a leader who really wants to speak, you know, on behalf of the community in the best interests of your community. Has that always been something that's important to you, even in your starting kind of points of getting into business?
Yeah, of course. I think that, you know, for me, I'm not from Member 2. I'm very privileged to work there and work for the community and for their benefit. But I, you know, I think as my career started, I've always, you know, had a desire to do good for Cape Breton. You know, I had opportunities to leave and that's not where I wanted to be. You know, my family's here. My parents are here. And I think it's important to be able to give back to where you live and give back to organizations that you've, you know, received from. So I sit on the board of the Hospital Foundation, which is, you know, extremely important to me. I don't know that there's anybody here that hasn't been affected or needed the support of either the Hospital Foundation or her hospital. So doing things like that, you know, in addition to the work you do, I think is important. And I'm, you know, privileged that, you know, the organization that I work for also is very committed to our community and to our greater community. So, you know, when we make investments and we build up these businesses, it's important to us that when we're looking at, you know, where we're spending those dollars, that there is a big portion that's given back.
Is that something that kind of, when you're in high school or college and you're deciding what you want to do, was that a big part of it? Was a way to give back to the community? Well, kind of, you know, not in this maybe nonprofit way, but in this way of generating jobs, generating economy, generating, like you said, wealth for the community. Was that something that you, like, you wanted to approach business from that way?
I think so. You know, I was lucky to grow up in a small community in Marion Bridge, and it was, you know, back then it was a tight-knit community, and it still is today. You know, they're still fortunate to have the same elementary school that I attended. And I think that, you know, we were always involved in our community growing up, whether it was participation in sports or participation in fundraisers for the community. And it was kind of something I think instilled by our parents to get involved and to give back. And so, yeah, I think early on, I always probably gravitated to things that allowed me to do that. I was, you know, pretty fortunate in my early career, just outside of university, I had the opportunity to work at Schwartz Furniture and work under Irving Schwartz. And I feel very privileged to be able to say that because, you know, he was, you know, a leading entrepreneur here. If people really understood what he gave back to, not just monetary, but gave back to entrepreneurs via advice, you know, and then that moved on to Brian Purchase, and I think he's doing the same thing today. So I try to still find myself in those situations where things that I'm doing have a component of giving back.
So can you also speak, you know, you mentioned a couple of boards that you were on. Are you able to speak about some other ones, the work that goes into being on these boards?
Sure. So I did spend, you know, a bit of time during my time at Member 2 on the Cape Breton Partnership Board, which I think has tremendous value here on the island, and they're doing a lot of great things. I've mentioned earlier about my work at the Hospital Foundation. Has a wonderful board doing fantastic things for healthcare on the island here. And then also, you know, I spent a bit of time doing some advisory work with CBU. You know, getting the opportunity to work with Dave Dingwall. You know, he's mentored me over the years and has always been a great person to lean on for advice. So I think, you know, people like Annette Verschuren, Anita DeLazar. I heard from Anita when I won this award, and she's somebody that I worked with on the CBU steering committee. And, you know, it was her and I were the only two women in the room. And I think that, you know, I've been lucky in my time here to support some great community initiatives, meet some wonderful people, and kind of get mentored along the way.
Do you find yourself kind of both in the mentor and mentee? Are you still always learning and still always trying to pass knowledge on?
For sure. And, you know, I think a lot of people assume that you're always learning from those above you or who came before you. But I can tell you that that's not, you know, realistic, and that's not my journey. I'm very fortunate that, yes, I've had, you know, people that have come before me, you know, great men and women. I've mentioned to you, and obviously there's no bigger mentor than Chief Terry Paul. I think I have the best job here, and I get to work with him every day and learn a lot about compassion and humility and fairness. So those are, you know, some things that I think he's instilled in myself. But also I have an extraordinary team that works, I like to say, with me, not for me. They challenge me every day and teach me new things. And then even outside of our own organization, you know, I have to give a shout out to the Danielles with Anchored, and, you know, they're such huge cheerleaders of not only me, but this community. You know, people like Kathleen Yurcherson, and so there's lots of people coming up, Allison Unsworth, you know, all those women were also there to support me for my award. And I think that it's important to always be mindful that there is opportunity to learn from people that aren't in your sector as well. Yeah, we get together quite often. Kelsey and Brittany that are on my team, they're always finding ways to elevate what we do at Member 2 as well. So it's great to be surrounded by some really great women.
Has there been a specific project? I know, Clearwater Seafoods is this new one, but has there been a specific project that you've really been so proud to be a part of?
You know, it's hard not to talk about Clearwater. So what I would say with that one is that one was generational. And it was also monumental in the sense of that happened during COVID. So, you know, you're doing a $1 billion transaction. You're having a conversation with the chief saying, we're going to buy Clearwater to start. And everyone in the room is laughing and saying, wow, like, are you serious? Do you really think that that's something that we can aspire to do? And he didn't waver. And so I think that one for me is the one that kind of really set the catalyst for everything else that has come after. And each one of those are unique and exciting in their own way. Coming together with a community in Newfoundland to buy one of the longest standing dockyards in Canada was pretty historic as well. And they all kind of, you know, relate to each other in some way, shape, or form, but they are all quite unique as well. Our latest acquisition with Genoa is a design company. So I would say that I'm certainly doing things in Member 2 and with Member 2 Development Corporation that I probably didn't envision many years ago. But now there's probably not much that would surprise me. So we see a lot of opportunities come our way. But I would also be remiss if I didn't talk about, you know, the port and how important it is for us to see that port get developed. And you know, I don't want anybody to think just because we're doing all this investing off island, you know, those revenues and that that money comes back here and gets spent here. But we're also very keen to invest here as well.
Is there any kind of, if any, you know, especially women specifically, kind of coming up in the business world, is there any kind of guiding advice that you kind of use every day? Is there anything that you would want to pass on?
You know, I guess a couple of things. I think we all get, you know, really busy. In this world of, you know, virtual meetings and things like that, sometimes you overschedule yourself and don't leave much time. And I had one of a great colleague give me some advice not that long ago, actually, to schedule think time. Literally put in your calendar blocks of time that just allows you to think. And this individual does it on a daily basis. I haven't quite got myself there yet, but I certainly have been putting more time in there for me. I think that continue to surround yourself with like-minded, but also, you know, people that you wouldn't expect that, you know, you're going to learn something from. You know, do those lunches, do those breakfast meetings, because they're all really important. And it's good to build a community of support around you as well, because, you know, in everything we do, there are good days and there are bad days. And you always remember the people that are around on the bad days. So I would just say, you know, find your people. Yeah, it's important.
That was Jennifer Dulesky, recognized by the Atlantic Business Magazine for her outstanding work in Member 2, and she was speaking with Dialogue's Cora Perrigo. And that's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.